My name's Anne Kavanagh and I'm Academic Director of the Melbourne Disability Institute and also Director of the Centre for Research Excellence in Disability and Health. I'm just going to start by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land in which our event is taking place today, the land of the Wurundjeri people, and I pay my respects to their elders past, present and emerging. So the Centre for Research Excellence in Disability and Health, which I'm director of, includes about 5 universities and 10 chief investigators and associate investigators, and it's looking at the social determinants of health for people with disabilities. And Zoe Aiken, who's speaking today, is employed through that centre, and Rebecca Bentley is one of the associate investigators. It's also co-hosted by the Melbourne Disability Institute, which is an interdisciplinary institute that exists across the University of Melbourne, bringing people across disciplines together to work with external stakeholders, advocates, service providers, government and so forth, to solve the kind of thorny problems around disability, of which housing must be one of the key concerns. So with no more ado, I'd like to introduce Peter Mayers, who's the author of The No Place Like Home, Repairing Australia's Housing Crisis, and a regular commentator and contributor to Inside Story. He's also the lead moderator of the Cronulla Program, an independent, not-for-profit organisation dedicated to developing ethical decision-making skills of Australia's leaders. Is obviously not working with current politicians.
No, we can't get them to come.
He's an adjunct fellow in the Centre for Urban Transitions at Swinburne University and has worked for 25 years as a journalist and broadcaster with ABC. So he's running this event today, so I'll hand over to Peter. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Anne, and thank you to the Centre of Research Excellence in Disability and Health and the Melbourne Disability Institute, University of Melbourne, for inviting me to facilitate this important discussion. As Anne mentioned, I published a book on housing last year called No Place Like Home. And in that book, I attempted to use journalistic techniques to make a complex issue more engaging and understandable to a general audience. So weaving data and academic research together with personal stories and interviews and so on, and tried to offer some practical suggestions for making things better. Indeed, the audacious subtitle of my book was Repairing Australia's Housing Crisis. It was a publisher's suggestion. But the book has been well received and it's got positive reviews, and I'm getting a lot of invitations to speak about housing at lunches and conferences and public forums and things. I'm acutely aware, though, as perhaps only an author can be, of the book's shortcomings. Inevitably, an overview of policy in a policy area as big as housing is going to glide over some particular difficulties, and my book, No Place Like Home, is no exception. I focus on housing in Australia's capital cities, for example, whereas the housing crisis also extends to rural and regional Australia. I've just come back from speaking in Byron Shire, for example, where I learnt that the Northern Rivers region of New South Wales has the most unaffordable housing in the nation and very high levels of homelessness and rental stress. So I failed to look at that issue, and I also failed to look at Indigenous housing. Yet we know that housing pressures disproportionately affect Australia's First Nation peoples. Fewer than 1 in 30 Australians identify as Indigenous, yet at the last census, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people accounted for 1 in 5 of those recorded as homeless. And then there is the specific and diverse housing challenges faced by Australians living with disabilities, the precariously placed, as the title of tonight's talk and tonight's event puts it. So I'm very glad to be here this evening to help raise the level of debate about housing, health and disability and the connections between them, and to learn from our expert panel and from you here in the audience more about this particular issue. So a quick word about format. We have 4 panellists, Zoe Aitken, Rebecca Bentley, Oliver Hunter and Joseph Connellan. They'll each get 5 minutes or so to make an initial presentation. I'll introduce them to you more fully as they come to the microphone, and then I'll engage them in a larger conversation about the issues. So I'd like to introduce Zoe Aitken from the Disability and Health Unit at the University of Melbourne. Zoe is an epidemiologist and her research focuses on the mental health inequalities experienced by people with a disability. And she has a particular interest in the complex interplay between disability and socioeconomic disadvantage and health. Zoe's going to help set the scene for us tonight, give us a foundation for our discussion by telling us what the data shows about the housing circumstances of Australians living with disabilities. Please welcome Zoe.
Thanks, Peter. So as you just said, I'm just going to be talking today about the findings of a study that we did describing the housing circumstances of people with disabilities in Australia. So in Australia right now, we know that many people struggle with the costs of housing. And the situation is particularly alarming for Australians with disabilities who are more likely to live on low incomes and may have particular accessibility requirements. Despite this, we identified a lack of studies that had described the housing circumstances of people with disabilities in Australia. And with the current implementation of the NDIS and potential changes to housing resulting from the NDIS, it's really important that we gain a comprehensive picture of what is currently happening, what the housing circumstances of Australians with disabilities is prior to the NDIS. So our study compared the housing circumstances of people with and without disabilities in Australia and looked at differences by types of impairment. We used data from HILDA, the Household Income and Labour Dynamics in Australia survey, and we used data collected in 2011, so prior to the implementation of the NDIS. This study is a nationally representative survey, and that allows us to draw conclusions about the entire Australian population with and without disabilities. So we use data from people aged 25 to 64 years, so the working age population, and we had over 11,000 people in our sample, of whom more than 2,500 people reported a disability and more than 8,500 people reported no disability. In our study, we examined a large range of housing characteristics. But in this presentation, I'm going to focus on unaffordable housing, and I'm going to describe some of the types of housing that people with disabilities live in, to put this into context, focusing on social housing and private rentals. So just briefly, how did we measure unaffordable housing? We used a commonly used definition of unaffordable housing, and this defines households as being in unaffordable housing if they're in the lowest 40% of the income distribution in the population, so low-income houses, that are spending more than 30% of their income on housing costs. And what did we find? Well, we estimated that 11.2% of people with disabilities were living in unaffordable housing. And this compared to 7.6% of people without disabilities who were living in unaffordable housing. So we found that the risk of living in unaffordable housing was much higher for people with disabilities compared to people without disabilities. And when we looked at this by different types of impairment, we found that there were notable differences in the proportion of people living in unaffordable housing. And particularly, we found that people with intellectual disabilities and psychosocial impairments had a very high risk of living in unaffordable housing. It was closer to 20%. Now, I'm going to move on to social housing. And what we found for social housing is that 7.9% of people with disabilities lived in social housing. And this was much higher compared to people without disabilities, of whom 1.5% lived in social housing. So the proportion of people living in social housing was about four times greater for people with disabilities compared to people without disabilities. And again, we looked at this by impairment type, and we found that people with intellectual disabilities had a very high proportion of them were living in social housing, almost 20%. When we looked at private rentals, what we found is that a large proportion of people with disabilities were living in private rental accommodation, 26%. And this was a similar proportion compared to people without disabilities, 29.5%. Again, we looked at this by impairment types, and we found a fairly similar proportion of people living in private rentals for all impairment types. Now, what does all this mean? So our research showed that prior to the NDIS, people with disabilities were much more likely to be living in unaffordable housing compared to people without disabilities. We also found that they were more likely to be living in social housing, and we found that a large proportion of them, more than a quarter, were accessing housing through the private rental market. These results were from data prior to the implementation of the NDIS. And this is concerning because despite the NDIS not covering the cost of housing for most participants, it's likely to generate greater demand for housing because more people with disabilities will be able to live independently. So our findings suggest that new strategies are needed to develop long-term housing solutions that promote independence and that provide affordable and accessible housing for Australians with disabilities. We published these results in a journal article earlier this year in Disability and Society. I'd like to acknowledge the contributions of my co-authors, a couple of them here today, and we produced a one-page summary of the findings. Thank you.
Thanks, Zoe. And can I just ask a follow-up question there? So what do you think, well, two follow-up questions, but what do you think explains the reason why more people with intellectual and psychosocial disabilities suffer from unaffordable housing than people with other types of disabilities?
Yeah, I can attempt to answer that. That's not something that we could look at in our study because we had access to data on population-wide data, which didn't explore why. However, we know from other studies that we've done that people with intellectual disability and psychosocial impairments tend to experience the most disadvantage in terms of other socioeconomic characteristics, such as employment and income. So I think those are probably the drivers of the housing unaffordability.
Similar kinds of problems in housing that they experience in other areas.
Yeah.
And the other question was, the data showing that a higher proportion of people with living with a disability are in social housing, in a way that's a positive thing, isn't it? Because it means that actually social housing is going to people who may need it most because otherwise they're struggling with unaffordable rentals in the private market.
Yes, absolutely. And we presented those statistics to really show, well, where do we need to target our efforts? Where are people with disabilities living? And where do we need more affordable housing?
Great. Okay. Thank you very much. So having had that overview of precarious housing situation for people living with disabilities, we're going to see how that fits into the broader landscape of Australia's housing system. Our next speaker is Rebecca Bentley. She's Associate Professor and Research Fellow in Social Epidemiology with the Centre for Health Equity at the Melbourne School of Population and Global Health here at the University of Melbourne. And her research explores the role of housing and residential location in health and wellbeing. And she's particularly interested in the impact of unaffordable housing on people's lives. Rebecca.
Great. Thank you, Peter. So I'm keen to talk today more broadly about precarious housing and why we have precarious housing in Australia and maybe paint a bit of a picture of our housing system. So our housing system is quite fascinating. I mean, in Australia, we've got some of the most unaffordable housing in the world. So how do we get to this position? It's a wicked problem. It's a problem that we've been trying to solve for a long time. And the people that benefit from it and the people that are disadvantaged by it are quite different populations. So it's a very interesting thing to think through. I'm going to, first of all, go over our housing system as it currently stands and give some statistics on, you know, the structure of it and what we know about housing condition and other things in Australia, and then reflect a little bit on what this might mean for people with disability. And I think this is a good approach to take because I think that a lot of people with disability are in the precarious housing sector in Australia, and it's a good way to think about it. I also think that if we get our housing right, that we'll help a lot of people in Australia, including people with disabilities. So, in terms of our housing structure, we have a lot of home ownership in Australia. So we've got about the vast majority of our housing system is either outright owners or owners with a mortgage. Then we've got a reasonably large private rental sector and a reasonably small social housing sector. Between 4 and 5%, depending on what statistics you use, of our housing sector is comprised by social housing. And you can compare that to the United Kingdom, for example, around 20% of the housing sector's social housing. So it's providing a very different structure in our housing system, or a different role in our housing system. So we've got less protection built into our housing system with our smaller social housing sector. We've estimated from our research that there's probably about 1.1 million people in Australia living in what might be considered poor condition dwelling. Now, this is an estimate because there's not actually a survey of housing condition in Australia. So the last time it was collected by the Australian Bureau of Statistics was in 1999. We're currently undertaking pilot work to try and estimate this, and this is the best estimate that we have, but we'll keep you posted as our work progresses. Now, in terms of housing affordability, this is the thing that hits the headlines. We've estimated there's probably around 1.2 million of the 7.7 million households in Australia that are in housing affordability stress. And that's using the same measure that Zoe cited before, so spending more than 30% of people's income when they're in the lowest 40% of the income distribution. I've got a graphic there about, you know, you're a Melburnian when you can't afford a house. So Melbourne and Sydney particularly prone to this problem. And as I've said, we are living in some of the most unaffordable housing markets in the world. But it's not just about condition and affordability stress. It's important to think about mobility. And part of the way that we like to think about precarious housing is about people who are forced to move from housing when it's not their choice. So either by eviction or because it's because of a landlord's decision. They're going to, for example, move into a house, so someone has to leave it with notice. So we've estimated that about 1.5% of households have a forced move a year. But this is higher in the private rental sector, so this is up to about 6% in the private rental sector. So the private rental sector can be characterised as a less stable sector than the social housing sector and the owner-occupied sector. We've also estimated that people with mental health problems are 2 times more likely to have experienced a forced move. So again, it's quite a significant proportion of people encountering this problem in a reasonably vulnerable state. So it's not just a point in time thing that we need to think about, though. If we look at housing affordability stress over time, so if we look at people who, say, have been in housing affordability stress for 5 years or so, we find that a lot of people in this long-term state of high housing costs relative to income are either disabilities or carers. They're also single parents, and they're also less attached to the labour force. So there is a profile of people who are, you could say, stuck in long-term unaffordable housing who are reasonably vulnerable. And if we look at mobility, other work that we've done, where we've looked at people who have moved, we've looked at their housing situation prior to moving, and if they're in unaffordable housing, we've looked at where they've moved to. And we've looked at this in terms of the resources that they're able to access, so we've used an index of disadvantage. And what we've found is that people generally who move when their housing is unaffordable, so they might be moving because of that reason, generally make a downward move. So they're more likely to move somewhere that has less resources. And what we find that this is more so for people with disabilities. So people with a disability who move because their housing is unaffordable are much more likely to move to an area that's got less resources. We would call it a downward move. And we also need to think in a bigger picture time frame. So here we're thinking about generational cohort experiences of our housing system. And what I've got here is a slightly complicated graphic. Along the bottom, we've got years from 2001 to 2016. And along the other axis, we've got people's age. And what we've observed is the generational cohort who were 55 in 2001, that the extent to which, if they entered housing affordability stress, they were able to get out of that state of housing affordability stress. So that was set at about 55 years in terms of saying there's a reasonable probability of exiting. So people who are slightly older, this describes a pattern of them being stuck in unaffordable housing, finding it hard to get out once they enter it, particularly close to retirement. And as we move closer to 2016, the age at which people's ability to exit unaffordable housing decreases, so we get a larger group of people, so about 48 years to retirement age, where it's actually harder to get out of unaffordable housing once you're in it. Now, what this means is that we've got a growing vulnerable group in our population, and you'll have seen this in the media reporting of older people, predominantly women who either through health problems or loss of attachment to the labour force might end up in housing affordability stress and precarious housing. This is also an age at which people are likely to either acquire a disability or be living with a disability. So it has implications for disability housing as well. So just to finish, I'd like to draw attention to the private rental sector in Australia, which has less secure housing. There's more unaffordable housing. It's got less security and possibly less or poorer quality dwellings, although, as I've said, research is ongoing in that space. I also want to argue that we should pay attention to where affordable housing is located, and this is particularly important for people with disabilities. So unless affordable housing is located next to transport and employment and opportunities that people can take up within their community, you know, it's going to remain problematic. And finally, I think we need to pay attention to social changes over time. So we need to think about how our changing housing system and housing affordability is actually driving social change. So the example of the changing experience of generational cohorts and the age at which people who enter unaffordable housing might actually have more difficulty getting out is quite pertinent and important to think through. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Rebecca. And just, again, a follow-up question. So you showed that statistic that 1.2 million out of 7.7 million households are in affordability stress. Of that 1.2 million, how many would be renters and how many would be... Because there's two forms of housing stress. There's rental stress, where the rent is more than 30% of your low income, and there's mortgage stress, where the mortgage repayments are...
Look, I can't give the exact number, but my understanding is it's mainly made up of people in the private rental sector. And so predominantly in unaffordable housing in Australia, it's people in the private rental sector who, you know, experience the brunt of it more, which is ironic given that a lot of support for housing affordability is targeted at owners.
As we're seeing in the latest announcements over the weekend in the election campaign, the question in Australia is almost always framed around housing affordability to buy rather than housing affordability to rent. And so the other implication from both your presentations is that security of tenure in the housing, in the private rental market is a key, or the lack of security of tenure is a key issue. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think that the problem with the private rental market and affordability is that people seem to either be getting, as I said, spending more than, 5 years in unaffordable housing. It's almost like stuck in unaffordable housing in one scenario. The other scenario is that if they're forced to move, they may make a downward move and end up somewhere worse. So that issue of mobility is quite important, and it's, you know, potentially problematic either way.
Okay, thank you. So our third speaker is going to give us a more personal take on the topic. Oliver Hunter is an aspiring comedian and media personality. He currently works for the Alcott Foundation's Get Skilled Access program. And Oliver lives in Albury but is planning to move to Melbourne to advance his career. And he's going to tell us about his recent experience in trying to find a place to live in our fair city. So over to you, Oliver.
Yep, so thanks for that, Peter. Yeah, so I'm trying to move to Melbourne. I'm currently still living at our home with my family in Albury, which is good. They're nice people, but it's definitely time to move on from my parents, and they'll tell you that as well. Mum told me that yesterday. I think I got a taste for living independently when I was at university. I went to Wollongong Uni for 3 years and then sort of had to come back because I knew whether it was a subconscious level at that point, and it's more conscious now, but I knew that it was going to be hard to find accessible housing, whether in Melbourne or in Wollongong or anywhere. And I knew that I could come back to my parents' house, and I had a job in Albury. So that was always difficult to cope with, and now it's definitely time to move again. And it was nice sort of living completely independently. You could come home at 2 a.m. after a night out and not worry about your dad judging you. That was always nice. So it is hard coming back. And it's hard as well because there are some great projects going on that I will happily be a part of to advocate or to contribute to for housing. But it's hard when all these projects are there saying, oh, it's 3 years off, it's 5 years off, it's coming. That's great, but like, what do I do now? Like, I'm 24, do I wait 5 years, then I'm 29 going on 30 and I'm still living at home, and I'm 10 years behind in my career as opposed to the rest of my peers or even my siblings. Like my 18-year-old brother's just committed to move to Melbourne in September which is great for him. He's a hipster barista, so good on him. But then I'm still stuck at home by myself. At least I had my brother there to talk, like, you know, have a good relationship with. But when he moves away, it's like, okay, I can't do that because I can't just jump into a regular, you know, standard apartment. But then when I go to access these services or projects that are already up and going for accessible housing, I get told that, oh, you're not, basically you're not disabled enough, like you're not, your level of support isn't high enough for you to access this housing. So then you just are sort of stuck in the middle, and that's hard to cope with too, because you want to go to these services because you think, great, they've provided accessible house, a bathroom, I'll go there, I'll live there, they've ticked all my boxes, but then you don't tick their box, so then you're sort of stuck again. But then they tell you, oh, you can go and access mainstream housing. You're independent enough and you can do that. So then you go to a flatmates.com site where you can put up a profile and talk about what you need and what you can offer a house. And then you go and look at the house and the shower is in the bath. And you go, well, I can't climb over the bath. And I think people don't realise that it's little things like that, that you'll go and look at an apartment, for example, and the door to the bathroom will open inways. And then that cuts your space by about a third, and then you don't have enough turning circle to turn around to the shower or to the toilet, or there's not a rail in the toilet. So then, but people who are putting, you go and tell people that might be able to do something, but they actually don't know that that's as simple as it could be. Like, have the door open outways, put a temporary rail that you could easily take out when I don't live there anymore, or you know, you can do those sort of things. But that shows that there's a systemic problem still, even with the NDIS coming in, which is, I thought, was meant to help someone like me live independently and work and access private rentals and still do all that. But you're still getting knocked back because, for whatever reason, it's hard as well, because I could contact the NDIS tomorrow and say, I want to live at home. Can you modify our kitchen at my parents' house? It would probably take 12 months, but they would say yes to that because they go, well, that's an investment. We know, okay, you're going to live there for forever as far as we're concerned, so we'll modify your kitchen for you. But they don't want to, you know, help me find a rental or, you know, a 12-month rental with roommates because they think, oh, well, that's too hard, or what we do have already for that you're not qualified for, which is hard to cope with. And you know, living it in Albury, it's a great place to grow up and a great place to live. Like, I've got friends that'll live there forever, but they're tradesmen and footballers, and I'm neither of those things and never plan to be. So it's hard for me. I'm just sort of, I don't really belong there, but then I try and move to the city, to the metro areas, and live that, you know, cool hipster life, but I don't get access to that either. So it is quite difficult to cope with. But, you know, you try and stay positive, which is hard because you want to be optimistic and you want to advocate for all these things and bring in a positive young vibe to it all. But then you get knocked back yourself. And then I know Dylan Alcott working with him, and it's hard to look at him sometimes and go, he's doing it all. Why can't I do that, you know? But then you talk to him and he goes, he owns a place in Collingwood. And you go, that's awesome, but I can barely afford to make toast. So I actually just quit my job, so if anyone's got something going, that'd be great. Come and see me afterwards.
What are you looking for?
Anything. Well, at this point, I can't make coffees, though. I can't reach machines, but that's a whole other issue of access to employment. So yeah, I think, but you do, you try and stay positive, you do, and I'll keep looking, and I'll keep ringing people and keep emailing people to see if I can come up with something. But when you think you're onto something like a project that provides accessible housing, and then you get told no, you're not disabled enough, you're like, oh well, that's good, but what am I supposed to do? Like, what am I supposed to do? And yeah, apart from just live at home with my parents and my dog. My dog's great, but mum's getting a bit eerie. So, anyway.
So. Oliver, can I ask you, how close have you come to finding a place in Melbourne?
I thought I was pretty close with some. There was a project called Summer Housing, and they was great people, and they said, "Yeah, we provide." And based on all their brochures and all their stuff, I looked at, they were like, "I'm like, this is perfect." And then they said, "Oh, you need SDA, which is that specialist disability accommodation within the NDIS," and I couldn't access that because I wasn't impaired enough. But that's exactly what I need. I need the funding to build, to renovate a bathroom. But I wasn't, didn't qualify. So then you sort of sit there in no man's land.
And in terms of private rentals and share housing and things like that, is the primary barrier that the housing you could afford simply isn't going to have the right bathroom or kitchen? Or is it, or is it also that it's simply too expensive?
Bit of both. So I had a cousin who works down here in property management, and she emailed me with some properties, and she said, "Oh, it's got a lift. It's a building with a lift." And I went, "Great, but it's $600 a week." So I can't afford that anyway. But then you go, "Oh, it's got a lift." So you get up the lift, and the bathroom's the size of the my wardrobe at home, and I can't get in there. And then you look at these sites with, you know, all these share houses on it, like, or apartments, a nice apartment in Richmond, and you look at that, and on paper it looks great. And then you, even just looking at a photo, I can just tell that the bathroom isn't big enough, or the kitchen. The kitchen I can deal with, but it's more the bathroom. And it's hard to email a landlord and go, "Oh, do you mind just knocking out that wall so I can go to the toilet?" Mm. That'd be great. yeah. So that's
and I presume too that you won't get funding to renovate or change a wall in a rental accommodation, because you're, for exactly the reasons we heard about before, your tenure there is going to be uncertain.
Yeah.
And so are they going to invest in something? You might only be there a year or less.
That's the hardest thing, because I want to live that, you know, that sort of young person share house life, which I think I am more than capable of doing and have the right to do, just like anyone else. But that's the sort of thing that landlords who aren't necessarily educated just yet, or, you know, property management companies or real estate agents, they just go, "Well, we don't want to." But then they realise that if you do that sort of thing, my support needs would come down, because I would be able to live independently. So from an NDIS point of view, when they provide me with money just for support, if they provided accessible accommodation, the other stuff would come down. And that in the long run.
And your sense too is that if you could live in Melbourne, you'd get more work.
I get more work, and I'd give me a little bit, and I might get famous. but yeah, that was the idea. So that, whereas Albury, you keep coming down to do this work that I'm already doing, and it's great to do that work, and great to be an advocate. And I worked at the Dylan Alcott's Music Festival about a month ago, and that's awesome to be a part of. But and then I go home to Albury, and I have to keep coming back, and you don't feel part of Albury, but you don't feel part of Melbourne, so you're just kind of stuck in the middle there.
Well, thank you very much, Oliver. Our final speaker is Joseph Conlon. He's worked in the not-for-profit sector for 35 years on developing housing for people with disabilities. He's currently Senior Manager of the Housing Pathways Program at the Melbourne Disability Institute. And last year he published the Two Hands Report about the National Disability Insurance Scheme, the NDIS, and housing. Joseph.
Thank you, everyone. I'm also from country New South Wales and am neither a tradesman or a footballer, so that's why I'm in Melbourne. I have great sympathy. I've been working around this space around NDIS and with disability and housing for a long time, around NDIS and housing for about 3 years. And essentially what I'm trying to do is construct, I suppose, a new way of talking, a new language, a new set of ideas. So what I'm going to do tonight is run through some big ideas. Some will make sense, I hope, some may not. The first thing I want to talk about is the wackiness that is the NDIS. People sort of miss it. They talk about it as a program. It's not a program. It involves a million people with a new idea. Why do I say a million people? Because there's 460,000 participants, and for every participant, there's a family member or a support worker or a carer. That's an extraordinary number of people. It's been described as a $22 billion washing machine, because it's not as though we actually took a system and made it bigger. We have dismantled the entire system and started again. When you talk to people overseas about the NDIS and talk about what it is, they say things like, "You're very brave." So people ask me whether the NDIS is a good idea, and I say it is, and it can be, but that's where we are. That's all we've got to work with. We have nothing else. We've burnt the bridges behind us. In all of the presentations I've done about housing around the country, the one thing that has resonated most with people I talk to is nothing to do with housing. It's this diagram here. It comes out of the Gartner hype cycle. It's about introduction of new technology. The example would be a new when we had smartphones introduced. And it talks about what happens. You get this excitement when something new happens. You get the peak of inflated expectation. Yep, I've got this phone. I can do everything with it. and then you fall into the trough of disillusionment. I don't know how it works. I can't get the buttons to work. Is this sounding familiar? Then over time, you figure out how things happen and you work up the slope of enlightenment to the plateau of productivity. I just love this language. The importance of this is everybody I know working in different disability policy practice or the participants or their families are a part of this extraordinary up and down journey. So that's why it's a complex environment. That's why we're not having these really well-balanced, rational, planned discussions, because people are just trying to get through the day, trying to understand what NDIS is. And thinking about it, people talked about these numbers before, but crudely, there's probably 50 to 70,000 NDIS participants looking for housing, which is an extraordinarily good thing. Because in the past, people have never had a capacity to move because they've never been able to access support. So we have this really good problem, but it is a problem. So my work at the Melbourne Disability Institute is it's a seven-month project where I've got to find housing for 70,000 people. I've got about a month left and it's not going so well. But anyway, we're trying. I think one of the things we've got to do is go back and think about some really fundamentals. The old language doesn't work. The old conversations don't work. The old, simply even having the same people around the table doesn't work. We need new people. We need to go back. And the first thing we need to do is get rid of this term disability housing. I've always thought it's weird, because how is the housing disabled? We need to talk about what stops people from accessing and maintaining housing. And it may be simply that they can't afford it. It may be that the property is not well located or is inaccessible. The bathroom doesn't work. It may be that the housing management is not robust enough to withstand the way they travel through life, which could be a bit exciting. Maybe they don't have enough information to build what they want to do, whether it's a service or a house or whatever. Or maybe they just need some assistance to move from that time of living at home with their family to move out, and not just the person with disabilities. Maybe the family needs some help as well to cope with that, which is something that can be quite a radical change. My point would be that we don't need to solve the disability housing problem. We need to attack the individual barriers that affect individuals with disability and only do that. We don't need a generic housing solution. When we've done that in the past, whether it's in institutions or group houses, it hasn't worked out so well. And now with the NDIS, we actually have the resources to begin to attack these things in a different way. I also think it's really important we get an understanding of what the housing system looks like for people with disabilities. And what we've done is created essentially a number of segments which are familiar to you, but what we're trying to do is get everybody talking about the same thing. So essentially what we've done is broken into new and existing SDA. SDA is the NDIS-funded specialist disability accommodation. There's a segment called non-SDA supported accommodation, which picks up things like supported residential services, but probably also things like hospitals. So what I'm sort of doing is creating these places where we can place things to have a conversation. There's social housing, which we've talked about previously. There's private rental. There's in your own home, which is very unusual for people with disabilities because they typically are poorer than the rest of us. They have very low levels of home ownership. And there's those living in the family home, whether it's under and over 25, 25 being the magical move-out date nominated by the NDIS. My observation from some of my friends' families is their kids seem to stay longer than 25, but that's just me. So I think the point about having something like this, you can place ideas in it and you can see displacement. So, for example, I know that 95% of NDIS recipients are eligible for social housing. I know they won't get in. So they will be displaced into the private rental market or they will be left at home. I think what we've got to think about is what's happening in this NDIS world. This extraordinary sense of change and optimism as we move from a time of people being constrained by their disability and their funding to a time when we can address the limitations of their capacity. And I think about capacity has been limited in three ways: their financial capacity, cognitive capacity, and most often their financial capacity. So I suppose what we're trying to do is essentially working together with communities at a very amorphous level, like tonight, having a conversation, or a very structured level with particular communities, to try and work to build that entitlement. One of the great strengths and weaknesses of the NDIS is it's entitlement-based. And I think that's great. If you've got an entitlement to the top, if you're in the top 6%, you've got an entitlement. It's tricky, but you can get there. If you're on the other 94%, your entitlement is to join a waiting list. It's not actually to get a house. So we only move beyond entitlement with, I think, the intervention of community. So what we're trying to do is essentially do a number of things. With the Pathways Project, we are creating information that is accessible. So we, for example, have a system where we have thousands of local area coordinators coming in providing advice who might have very limited background in housing and maybe one of 10 things they've been asked about that day. So we're going to provide robust and accessible information to them. We've got to provide training in ways that they can find useful. And these are both in digital form and actually doing face-to-face, that sort of thing. So we're trying to develop these very practical resources. We're also doing something working with specific communities. So I'm working with the community of Castlemaine, and the logic goes something like this. The NDI is creating enormous opportunity for people with disabilities in your community. So about 50 people in your communities will get many more services. 9 of them will be entitled to SDA funding. This is an opportunity for your community, not some abstract thing. For these are people in your community, but it won't happen without your intervention. So what we're doing is bringing together those leaders in the community. So you think about the real estate agent, the member, the local councillor, the member of the Rotary Club. And in those country towns, that's often the same person. So you get those 5 or 7 people in the room and begin to educate them about what the possibilities of the NDIS are in terms of social activity, but also economic, because the NDIS does represent real jobs in a place like Castlemaine. And then, of course, moving beyond that sort of practical approach, we are, at a community level, we're linking people across particular areas of expertise. This is quite a specialised area, so often people in different states share an expertise, but not there's nobody else in their particular state. So I travel a bit, I talk to lots of people and try and bring them together. And we also link, of course, to the researchers, because we know that the mantra is the NDIS is a research and a fact-based scheme, so we need the facts verified. So the big question is, what, if I'll just unpack this a bit, what can we do? There's a lot of talking about what others should do, but my conversations are also, what about what can we do to deliver housing solutions? So it's not a particular house, a particular form, it's a solution. It could be private rental, it could be home ownership, it could be a million things, but it's a housing solution to capture this extraordinary opportunity. In 35 years of working in this space, I've never seen a social change like this. I'm a bit stunned that it is actually happening in disability. What I know is 2 things. It is an extraordinary opportunity and it is time limited. So we need to work together. We need to grab this opportunity now and deliver the great promise of the NDIS, because I think that is premised on good housing. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Joseph, and I'm going to ask you a couple of follow-up questions. So I think the point you're making, and others made it as well, is that the NDIS creates a good problem. The good problem being that because people have more portable services and more choice over their services, they are more likely to be able to live independently. So the good problem is they've got greater independence. The problem part of it is finding housing that then they can afford or access. Is that?
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, we're simply bringing people with disabilities broadly up with everybody else, except they are poorer because they've had less access to work. We have a very low level of employment of people with disabilities in Australia.
Yeah, so they're poorer and they may have specific challenges, as we heard from Oliver, in finding a house that suits them, or in holding down a tenancy if they have maybe mental health issues or something like that. So they've got specific sets of problems. Now, one thing that struck me in your presentation were 2 words in one of the diagrams, which were, I think, choice and control, which is what the NDIS promises, and the other one was reasonable and necessary. Now, it seems to me this is exactly Oliver's problem, right? He wants choice and control, and they're offering him choice and control, and then he's been told, but what you're asking for is not reasonable or necessary. Is that fair? You know, there's a tension here between choice and control and what's seen as reasonable and necessary.
Yes, no, I mean, one of the things about the NDIS is that it is an immature scheme, and by that, I mean, it doesn't have a sophisticated corporate knowledge. In Victoria, we have the Transport Accident Commission, which has some similar bones to it. It's actuarial-based, deals with people with high needs. And they have a period of about 15 years did come to that realisation that Oliver actually understands, that if you give people good housing, costs come down. So I think those 2 things converge over time. The scheme is just not mature enough to actually understand that.
But is there, and I'd invite other panellists now to jump in as well on this, is there a bigger question here, which is that we fail to understand as a nation that actually investing in housing would reduce costs overall? So, you know, if you said, and I take your point, Joseph, there's not one cookie cutter solution here. We're talking about individual solutions for individuals with disadvantage. But actually, more affordable housing and more social housing is a kind of cookie cutter solution that would benefit a lot of people with and without disabilities.
Well, and I'd probably add to that, Peter, that getting our housing right is also a poverty prevention strategy. So you can think of it not just in terms of, the conversation we're having at the moment, but actually in terms of a prevention conversation. So putting money into housing, it's hard to quantify what the gain would be financially, but you certainly know that you could actually make an amazing social contribution if you had, you know, a housing system that had the right safety nets in place to prevent poverty.
So because we know that the level of public housing in Australia has gone down from something like 7% of all households in 1990 to 4% today. So there's been a massive decline in the availability. Joseph?
This requires a political and community-based approach, which is also the rationale. So, I mean, you know, we are at this extraordinary time. People with disabilities are coming into our community, supported by the NDIS. The NDIS is an extraordinary thing. But the country has said that they are prepared to give people a fair go and they're prepared to put serious money and serious political change into it. So now's the time.
Okay, look, thank you very much for your attendance here this evening, and thank you particularly to Melissa Kavanagh, who hasn't just been running around with a microphone but actually organised this whole event, and to other staff at the Centre of Research Excellence in Disability and Health and the Melbourne Disability Institute here at the University of Melbourne. And above all, please join me in thanking our four speakers, Zoe, Rebecca, Oliver and Joshua.